This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 229, Summer, of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So, Summer, are you excited about tonight? Or I should say, this episode?
I am. I was a little overwhelmed when I got my audiobook out to listen to it on the ride to work, and it was like, chapter one, 1 hour and 40 minutes. And I was like, dang. It was long.
No, I think it was like 124 or something. I was like, really? I was like, oh gosh, it's going to maybe take as long to take notes from this as it did an episode of season three. But I was pleasantly surprised. Now, Summer and I, of course, are alluding to, what are we doing in this episode, Sam?
This episode, we will be discussing chapter one of Drums of Autumn.
So before we get to our DOA, Drums of Autumn read-along, which we're so excited to do because we have new music too. Holla! We have to get through our final feedback for season three, and that is for episode 313, Eye of the Tiger. I'm just kidding. Eye of the Hurricane. I'm just kidding. Eye of the Storm.
First up is Amy D.
Hey, Ginger and Summer, it's Amy D with some feedback for the season three finale, Eye of the Storm. I enjoyed many things about this final episode. Galus's special brand of crazy, young Ian's saucy attitude, Lord John dressing Lieutenant Leonard down, and the longing look he gave Jamie as Jamie walked away, Claire's takedown of Galus, the sweet reunion on the Artemis where we finally got the 17th century version of phone sex that we missed from earlier in the season, and so much more. I felt like Matt Roberts and Tony Graffia did a really good job of taking care of all the important points without making the episode feel rushed. Aside from the story itself, I found a number of things extremely beautiful from a strictly visual standpoint. The bringing back of the Druid dancers, the shot of the stones on top of the hill where the cave was, Claire after she went overboard and Jamie swimming to save her, the shot of the eye of the hurricane as the camera pulled away from Jamie and Claire in the ocean, and the way the camera panned out from the two of them on the beach and then raced inland, showing the American landscape. I felt like this episode was a treat not only for our minds and our hearts, but for our eyes as well. The season as a whole has had its ups and downs for me. I agree with Ginger that a number of the things that were written after the print shop episode were just not in character, which for me yanks me right out of the story. It's almost physically jarring when Claire or Jamie behave in a way that's out of character, especially when they've lived in my mind as they were originally written since I first read Outlander like 14 years ago. However, when I look at the entire season, there was definitely more good than not good, and the scales tip heavily in the "this season was awesome" direction. Whatever flaws I might find in the show from time to time, it is never, and I repeat, never, the acting. Sam, Katrina, Laura, Stephen, Roman, Cesar, John, David, Gary, Lotta, they all get it right. Every single time. Their work is a gift to us, and I could not be more grateful for the way that they have brought this story and these characters to life. And as the Golden Globe nominations just came out today, I'd like to say a huge congrats to Katrina on a well-deserved nomination. And I'd also like to give a shout-out to our James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, Sam Heughan. He wasn't nominated, yet again. I'm still confounded by the lack of attention paid to his portrayal of this complex character. I realize that the books are, at least mostly, told from Claire's perspective, but let's face it. If Sam doesn't get Jamie right, not much else in this show will work. And Sam gets it right. Always. So as season three closes, kudos to our cast. You absolutely rock. Additionally, I continue to be so enthralled with Bob Bear McCreary's work. As a musician myself, I'm always so impressed with the way he tells the story with sound, weaving a whole new layer of the story, seamlessly merging the sounds of Scotland and the Caribbean and the American colonies. His music becomes a character all its own, and it's one of my very favorite parts of the series. And as Droughtlander commences, and I look ahead over the next 9 to 10 months as we wait for season 4, I think about what I'm looking forward to the most as the show moves forward. The idea that men and women in their 40s and 50s can still be passionate and sexy. That the romance of a relationship can continue long after the initial honeymoon phase. That everyday life can be just as interesting and fulfilling as a swashbuckling adventure. I do love this next phase of Jamie and Claire's life, and I can't wait to see what wonders Sam and Katrina will do with it. Thanks for the fun this season, lasses. Can't wait to start the Drums of Autumn
read-along with all of you. Marlo R. writes, "Hey, Ginger and Summer. On this, our last listener feedback of season 3, you know I couldn't let this go by without commenting on the amazingness that was Lord John Grey in this episode. Although the scene only lasted a few minutes, it was my favorite scene of the episode, and I think had so much meaning. I was a little concerned when they had Jamie taken away by the soldiers at the end of 312, but it really set up the scene. It allowed Lord John to do what he does best, and what I believe is one of his main purposes in the story, and that is to take care of / look after Jamie. In typical Lord John Grey fashion, he was able to swoop right in and save Jamie from a boatload of trouble, and he did it in amazing style. But what I really loved about this scene was more than what Lord John Grey said. It was why he was saying it. I believe this scene was created, because this doesn't happen in the book, to really cement in viewers' minds the validity and strength of Jamie and Lord John's friendship, and to show the strength of Lord John's character, how he will fight for and protect those he loves and holds dear. Lord John is not some lovesick man, although he does play that very well. He is a fierce friend to Jamie. And to coin a phrase, he is someone who would move heaven and earth to keep the Jamie safe and throw in a few snide lieutenants in while he is at it. If anyone was on the fence as to whether or not they liked Lord John before this scene, I can't imagine they were after. John truly loves and cares for Jamie at no cost to Jamie, which is a stark comparison to other redcoats that have come into Jamie's life. And I do believe that Jamie had a moment in this episode while watching Lord John practically eviscerate Captain Leonard that he truly understood, acknowledged, and was grateful for what he has in Lord John Grey. Perhaps also in that moment, Jamie realized that he not only has a true friend in Lord John, and that they are very similar in the extent they will go to keep their loved ones safe, but that this is the man that is raising Willie. And since he cannot do that himself, maybe having a man like Lord John do it isn't such a bad replacement." Now we hear from Eileen P.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Eileen P. from Melville, New York. Although the opening with Claire was somewhat like episode 301, showing Jamie in the aftermath of Culloden, what it really reminded me was of Faith from season 2. It wasn't so much about the Faith theme music being played as it was the visual and cinematic elements. I was actually expecting to see a blue heron fly by. Now, if they really wanted to make it like episode 301, we would have seen the remainder of the episode in flashbacks. I think without those flashbacks, the opener was disjointed, but certainly thought-provoking. Overall, I really loved the season finale. Lord John Grey putting Lieutenant Leonard in his place was so awesome. Some fans have said that they never pictured him behaving that way. Come on, people. He's a major in the army. Lieutenant Leonard is not the first subordinate he's ever had to reprimand. Did you see the look on Jamie's face during Leonard's takedown? Priceless. We finally get Claire and Gellis together, discussing time travel and comparing notes. It was clear that Gellis's evil ways were fueled by insanity. Yes, young Ian, she did blather a lot. And Abandoui, I was on the edge of my seat as Claire's fierce mother lion emerged to protect her cub and killed Gellis in one swift, powerful stroke. Then we came full circle with a deja vu moment. Of course, you throw in the time travel element and deja vu becomes a bit confusing, but what the heck? Ding dong, the witch is dead. I really like Yo-Chin Cho's character development and happy ending with Margaret, a woman who can truly see him. Seeing Margaret channel Bree was amazing. I really enjoyed Jamie's sex plan. I applaud a man who plans. It's such a wonderful trait. Be prepared. No wonder his motto is just sweep pray. I also applaud the storm scene. That was incredible. How did anyone survive that perfect storm tsunami? Then Jamie jumping into the turbulent ocean to rescue Claire. He's a keeper. I am so looking forward to season 4. As they make a life in America. Droughtlander cannot be over soon
Linda
enough.
Linda G. writes, here is the one thing how I felt about this episode. It was awesome. A whole lot going on, but it did not seem rushed to me. I did, however, love the faith theme. OMG, tears, tears, tears. I do like the changes with Margaret and Yi-Tian Cho, aka Mr. Willoughby, at the end, ending up together. I was mesmerized by the underwater scene. It kind of brought me back to a Twilight experience, if you know what I mean. Brianna talking through Margaret brought some clarity of previous episodes. The most favorable part was the drum dance. Oh, how I loved it. From Lord John Grey to the Colony of Georgia gives me high hopes that we will be seeing somebody with the initial M in season 4. I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for entering my life and making me part of your Outlander family.
This week's episode is sponsored by Brooklinen. Buying great sheets is an easy way to upgrade your nightly routine. The right sheets can make or break a good night's sleep and help you feel better and well-rested every day.
And Summer and I love our Brooklinen sheets, and I wouldn't have any others.
They make quality, luxury, and bedding accessible to everyone, and it's a great gift idea. Even though quality sheets make for a quality sleep, most high-end bedding is marked up by more than 300% by the time it reaches the store. Brooklinen makes quality, luxury sheets and bedding accessible to everyone, and it's a great gift idea.
Now, why Brooklinen? Besides the reason Summer just mentioned. Well, they do some pretty cool things. They cut out the unnecessary markups, retail licensing fees, and manufacturing waste in order to offer high-end designs at exceptional savings across their collection. And they are the fastest growing bedding brand in the world because people absolutely love these products. And their sheets have over 12,000 five-star reviews.
And they were named winner of the best online bedding category by Good Housekeeping.
This is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to try these sheets today.
I love my sheets. And if you try these sheets, I know you'll love them too.
Brooklinen has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code OUTLANDER at brooklinen.com.
In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try for yourself or as a gift this holiday season. Give the gift of luxury sheets.
The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code OUTLANDER at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. Promo code OUTLANDER.
Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever.
And now let's hear from Jenny.
Hi, this is Jenny in Barrington, Rhode Island. I will say that overall, it's a great episode, even though my comments are probably a little bit, I don't know, not nitpicky, but not quite criticisms either. It was a great episode, but a couple of things kind of stuck out to me and bothered me a bit. The first one was just really weird. I didn't know if anyone else noticed it or if it was just me hearing things. But in the preview for the episode on 312, Claire said Craig Nadun right before when she was telling Jamie that there was a place just like Craig Nadun on Jamaica. And it stuck out to me whenever I was listening to the preview. But then when that moment came in 313 on the episode, she said Craig Nadun, as I thought she'd always said it since the beginning of forever on the show. And so I rewound it, and I swear it looks like they dubbed it in. Like, her mouth says Craig Nadun, But then her, like, the voiceover says Craig Nadine. So just a strange little nitpicky thing. Also, the other thing I thought was a little bit off was the Gayless Duncan cutthroat mannequin. Was a little bit, didn't look at all like Gayless, not at all. And they lingered on it a really long time, which was made me feel uncomfortable because it's a cutthroat and it doesn't super look like Gayless. But all that being said, otherwise, I love the episode. They worked in so many complicated themes and I felt like dealt with things that I wondered, like, how are they going to show this on the show? Like, the prophecy and the tie-in with Bree. And also, I loved how the lovely way that they handled Mr. Willoughby or Eaton Cho. I thought that was a great send-off for him. And then the episode kept going. I felt a lot of closure there after we left, you know, Mitchell just throwing us a bone of, here's some sexy time with Jamie and Claire. And it was like, thank you very much. And then there's a storm. And then it was just as in when I read the books, I was like, okay, yeah, I guess I'm on board. We're in America now. So I'm excited for next season. And I've loved listening to all the commentary. Thank you so much for this podcast. It's wonderful.
Megan P. writes, so this episode starts mysteriously and then right into Claire running headlong into trouble as per usual, which is part of what I love about her. Enter a particularly ballsy Lord John Grey. His takedown of Lieutenant Captain Leonard was epic and made me like him all the more. Can we talk a minute about how crazy town Gaelis is? Sheesh. She has her 200-year-old baby now and her music is super creepy. Next, I'm glad Jamie has cat-like reflexes, or Claire most certainly would have taken his head. I absolutely loved the two parallels between the African dancing and the Scottish dancing. That scene was perfect. I'm not surprised to see that we called Willoughby offing Campbell by making a life with Margaret. They deserve happiness, and I immensely enjoyed her reading of both Jamie and Claire, followed by Brianna coming through briefly. They definitely made quick work of this, but managed to keep the necessary tidbits. Tony and Matt are pretty much always on their A-game. The humming never ceases to freak me out, and the cave scene was as intense as I imagined, for sure. Afterward, Jamie needing to hold on to both young Ian and Claire is a testament to everything they've been through this season. Them back on a boat filled me with anticipation as I knew where their last leg of the journey would take them. I'm thrilled they kept Jamie's dirty talk. I mean, what's better than some sexy talk in Jamie's Scottish brogue? Girls, give me a Jamie or give me nothing. Claire is one lucky bish. I'm intrigued that they had Marsali make the journey with them. She has a pretty large personality, so I'm wondering how they're going to write her into all those scenes in Drums of Autumn, aka season 4, that she was previously absent from. I may be forgetting, but I don't recall Claire almost drowning, just her having a broken leg when they washed up on shore. I get the calm eye of the storm reference, but man, there was no way Jamie would have been able to find her. There's just no way. However, it's a show, and them always finding each other is one of my favorite things about the books and the show. They always beat the odds together. This sets us up nice for season 4, and I couldn't be any more excited. Droughtlander begins, though. May the books and rewatching keep us going. Until next time, ladies. And finally, let's hear from Melissa M.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Melissa from New Jersey. I have so many thoughts on the season finale. I've loved it so much. I wish it wasn't so short, but I loved it so much. First off, Ginger Bates theme to open the show. Oh my gosh, I know you were as excited as I was. My next thought was about Lord John Grey in this episode. He was so powerful, and I loved how he cut Lieutenant Leonard down to size. Lord John rocks, and I cannot wait to see him in future seasons. So I was so excited because my listener comments from, I don't even know what it was, totally and completely were validated. I loved that Claire and Joe Abernathy were looking at the bones, and I said I thought it looked like Claire remembered it. And in this episode, I was justified. Woohoo! She did remember cutting off Galus's head. Yay! It was so cool. I loved that into the show. I thought that was so cool. I was so excited about that. Speaking of cool, I loved the hurricane sequence. I loved when Jamie cuts the roof off of Claire and uses the breath through the kiss to keep them both alive. It was so beautiful, and I loved the fact that they were in legitimately the eye of the storm. Regardless, I have more to say, but only 90 seconds to do it. I'm sad that Droughtlander begins, but I'm excited for the Drums of Autumn read along with you guys. Thank you for all that you do. You guys rock. Thanks again. Bye.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be beginning the fourth book of the Outlander series entitled Drums of Autumn. We're going to start with the prologue. So this will be the prologue going into part one, O Brave New World, Chapter 1, A Hanging in Eden.
So we won't spend too long on the prologue because, as we know from previous prologues, to those who have read the books, they're more meaningful than those who have not. I mean, duh. But they become more meaningful once you have the information that she's maybe, alluding to. In the prologue, basically, what would a new book be without a new prologue from Diana? This one is about ghosts and how she, of course, Claire is our storyteller, how she's not afraid of them. How could she be afraid, she says, of the idea of her mother, her ancestors, and those who went before? Reading a book written by someone who is past. What else are we doing but recalling their thoughts to life? She offers us, we haunt ourselves, and it is the ghosts that we make that we fear.
What are the ghosts that you fear? What is the ghost that lurks in your heart in the deep, dark night that you find terrifying?
I don't think I have.
You have to have one.
I mean, like a boogeyman thing?
Sure.
I don't know.
Like, it's not even the clown under your bed from Poltergeist?
No, because I don't have clowns around me.
You don't have to have one. What if it just appears? I don't know. Creepy children. And this is part of being a parent that is always unsettling. The waking up in the middle of the night with a child staring at you.
That would be creepy. But I think the one thing, like we don't talk about a lot of other podcasts on our show. I know that. But one of the shows that I've gotten into this fall and I like binge listened and now I'm all caught up, but that is Lore. And I listened to all the shows, all the episodes, and one of the episodes he had on was about, if it wasn't called Robert the Doll, then that was like the main story. But anyway, it was about, and this is based on, I mean, it's documented, so it sounds wackadoodle, but it was based on a doll who went cray, like in the 50s. So not even like that long ago. And it was a present for a kid who was like, he was a kid whose parents were rich and busy and traveled a lot. And they wanted to get him something to keep him company. The thing you always hear. And then the doll, people got hurt. Things were happening in the house. And it was crazy. And that, even if it's all made up, okay, fair enough. It's still creepy as heck. Dolls are evil. I don't have any dolls. I don't want any dolls. And, yeah. So I'm not afraid of dolls. Like, I don't wake up in the night and go, oh my gosh, I'm glad there's no dolls. But if that is something that if because of that, I will not have dolls in my home. I'll say that. I don't like dolls.
I don't know many people who do that aren't children who have,
exactly.
who have.
Or collect them.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know. My friend Abby it's not only just dolls, but antique creepy baby dolls are like her
Abby. Oh,
phobia. I think the only thing that would make an antique, the antique creepy baby doll scarier is to have it covered in spiders. That would be the only thing that would make an antique creepy baby doll worse. She sent me this picture once of this place where they were doing some sort of a video shoot. And this person had like a curio cabinet, a glass curio cabinet full
of dolls,
of creepy antique dolls. And she's like, I'm in my own personal hell. And I was looking at it and I said, I may be wrong, but it looks like that's a real doll on like the second shelf. Like one of them was so lifelike. It looked like there was just a dead baby in the curio cabinet. So, I mean, it takes all kinds.
Okay, so yes, dolls are creepy, but you can choose, like, you don't have to bring them into your house, right? You have to be polite about it. When you go out and someone else has it, just avoid it. Look the other way. But if you have children, that's between you and your spouse or you and your child when they, whatever. I wouldn't say, it's not like a monster or a ghost or anything, but one of my phobias, which is really weird, really weird, but I've had it for like, you will know this because you were there when it developed, even though you may not know you were. So I have for, I am not a young chick anymore. I'm not a spring chicken. And I have since as long, I love the water. I love swimming. I will always love swimming. But as for as long as I remember, like in the ocean, it's one thing. Like, I don't want to, like, I'm a little bit not afraid of fish, but like, I don't want to, you know, really touch things or coral or want to cut my foot. You know, I'm wary and do my best to be safe in whatever water it is. But in a pool, I don't want to touch that drain or that pump on the side. It freaks the, you seen me in the pool. I will like scream if that little sweeper thing gets near me. So drains freak me out. Sweepers that move like tentacles.
They look like animals now.
I will not go. They look like, I know, Summer. I know. I will not go in the pool if it's on. Like our parents' pool, I will not go in if it's on. So that may be irrational, but I can tell you that I also, again, our parents' pool, not a big deal. But when I was doing a lot more swimming at the gym, I would get there like at, I would leave my house at 4:40, get there by like 5:55 so I could go in and be the first one there. Not because I had to be first, but I wanted to get the lane I wanted. And there's no saving lanes. So the only way to make sure you got the lane you wanted was to be there first or be there early. So I got in there and I was typically the first one there. And like, what am I going to do? Sit around in my suit and freeze to death while I just wait for one more human body to be around so I can jump into a pool and not be the only one? I felt like such a weirdo. Like, I wanted to get the lane, yet I was a little freaked out to get in that huge lane pool by myself. Lights were on. It wasn't dark. Oh, if it were dark, heck no. But Summer, I'm not going to lie. That still like gives me shivers. Like, I don't want to get, like, I know there's no sharks. I'm nowhere near a drain. And it's very shallow, right? It's only like 5 feet or something. But would that not scare you to get into a pool by yourself, a huge pool?
No, not so much.
When it's dark outside and the mist is coming, the steam is coming off and you're the only one. Oh, girl, I got in because I didn't want to be there standing half-ass naked when someone did come out. I'm like, okay, be in the pool. That's better. You can always like stand around and wait to swim until someone gets out there, but...
That'd be weird.
Oh,
you'd be judged.
Even talking about it gives me anxiety. Can you tell?
Clearly. So my take on the ghost thing is I completely agree with the statement that, you know, we do it to ourselves. Like we create.
What did I just do? I just gave you an example.
No, but wait, that we create these things for ourselves. For instance, I could go to bed and be completely nonplussed, not thinking about anything, just being like, I'm so glad I can go to bed now. I'm getting all cozy in my bed and I can fall asleep, no problem. But if my daughter comes in and she wakes me up and she's like, oh, can I get in bed with you? And I'm like, yeah, okay. So she'll get in bed with me. And then maybe something like the cat is meowing in the hallway. And she goes, what is he meowing at? And I'm like, I don't know, he's a cat. And then she's like, what if there's somebody in the house? And then she starts creating this reality in my head that now I'm like, go to sleep. You're being crazy. And then she goes to sleep. And then I'm laying there awake going, what if someone is in the house?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's we definitely are humans create most of our own problems.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. So on to chapter one. Are we ready?
I am ready. And I will start this by saying, and by I start this, I never really get to start these things. But before you start, I would like to say that because it's been a few years since I've reread this one, because I haven't been able to start reading this one again since we started the read along for Outlander. I would say that in my brain, I thought it took a lot longer to do the things that happened in the first chapter.
I know, huh?
Like so much happened in the first chapter that I was like, wow. But then I was like, well, it was 24 pages.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't have been too surprised, but a lot happened. A lot of things went down that I thought would take longer to get to.
Yes. And I think this is what we talked a little bit about, not content, but length and in generalities, like you just said, like so much happens. And that's true. But also there's a lot of stuff not to skip over, like, you know, I'm not skipping events. There's a lot of exposition that you don't need to take notes on. It's just there for the reader and it's great. And especially if it's your first time or second time, then absolutely, you know, soak it in. And I did I scanned to make sure I wasn't carefully scanned to make sure I wasn't going to miss anything important. But I think I got mostly important parts. And I was like, again, just coming off that season three, any episode, holy shebang. I'm not saying it's always going to be like this because there are some monster chapters in here like later on, but oh Lord Summer, this is like, a breath of fresh air, not in content, because we love both, but the breath of fresh air as far as not spending as much time taking notes or prepping, it's a little, and plus we know this stuff. The episodes, we don't know. So of course we're going to have to slow down a little bit. And on to part one, chapter one. Okay, so the chapter opens, with drums. What type of drums? Diana writes, quote, harsh military rhythm, unquote. How did it make Claire feel? Quote, echoed in the pit of my stomach as though I, too, were hollow, unquote. So it was so loud that this sound was meant to be heard over speech or gunfire.
Wow. I mean, they are.
That's freaking loud. And if you've ever been, Summer, you and I, oh, you didn't go. If you remember being around a marching band, how those drummers, and they're not like, I almost said they're not whacking off. I mean, well, okay, they're whacking away. Is that better? They're drumming away like what they're supposed to do to the rhythm on their parts. They're not coming in. They're resting when they're supposed to rest. They're doing their part, their role that they've practiced and rehearsed. But you know what? I'm not going to lie. And I love the sound of it. I do. Like when I was listening to the end of, how much was there much? There was more pipe than drum on the exit credits of 313, right?
It was very piccolo heavy. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't remember hearing or feeling the drums, but if you're ever,
it was like a snare. It was like a single snare. It would be like what I would imagine going into not battle, but like with like an army just kind of marching and they have the one drummer and the one piper kind of leading.
Okay. So the description that she just gave, that's something that's louder than gunfire. Gunfire is heck loud, right? I mean, it's obviously. Now, maybe gunfire today is louder than gunfire back then. I don't know that. But just to be louder than gunfire, period, it's got to have that like really sharp, percussive, like a sound that you really don't, like from a distance, you can appreciate the rhythm and the sharpness of it. But I'm not going to lie. Earlier this fall, like a harvest festival event, I think I went with our parents to take my niece to, your daughter, to her school event, whatever. A local high school marching band came and performed. It was really cool. But Summer, I'm not going to lie, I was outdoors and I was not that close to them. I had to hold my head and hold my ears. It hurt so bad. I mean, yes, I am like Little Miss Sensitive Muppet. Or
I'm going to call you that from now on. Little Miss Sensitive Muppet. That's what you are.
Anyway, I had to hold my ears. So just reading the description, like made me want to like cower in the corner and hold my ears, hold my head because I'm so sensitive to sound, which I know is rich, but I'm so sensitive to sound that, or to loud noises at least, and light and so many things that I can just imagine if Diana is describing it, that this sound was supposed to pierce above gunfire so that people, you know, understandably so that the troops who needed to hear it could hear it. Could you imagine this and being that close to it? Oh my God. It would like want to tear a hole in my eardrum because it hurts your head. Me, it hurts my head and my ears because it's so loud, but it's hitting that hollow drum. And it's like, you're feeling that, not a ricochet, that's not the right word, but you're feeling that like it's not a bass, like it's not a bass and you go into a club and you feel the bass in your chest. It's not like that, but you still feel that hit, that bang. It's just not, I don't find that pleasant. The fact that it's so loud, but that's me, Little Miss Sensitive Muppet. okay, so Jamie, Claire, Duncan Innes, and young Ian are in Charleston, South Carolina. It is June 1767, and it is hot and humid. Now we're no longer in Georgia, as I just said, but Summer can tell us a little bit about, and I've only did it like, well, I guess once or twice, but Summer and all of our listeners will know this. All the East Coast listeners, all the Southern listeners, us Californians who grew up in California, Summer, take like 20 or 15 seconds. Tell us about humidity in the South of the East Coast.
I've never experienced anything like it. And I experienced it. Here's the thing. I experienced it the first time. Not in the South, but when I lived in New York City. And I remember I got up in the morning and I took a shower and I put on my work clothes and I got out and I walked to the subway station. And by the time I got to the subway station, I might as well have turned back around and gone back home and taken a shower. I was sweaty and wet everywhere. And by the time I got home, I took another shower. Like it was, I've never experienced anything like that. And that was a a New York summer. And then when I lived in Georgia, I mean, it's soupy. It's so wet. And we had our air conditioning go out the summer after I had my daughter.
Oh,
so fun. It was a lot. I'm not a huge fan of humidity, and my hair definitely does not care for humidity.
Diana, as ever, brings this all alive with her description of the pungent man standing in front of Claire. He, quote, hadn't bathed in a month or more. The edge of the stock about his thick neck was dark with grime, and his clothes smelt sour and musty, unquote. So as they're standing there and we're still learning what's going on, the drums grew louder. A cadence called, quote, a dead march was being played, Claire believes. So they are in this spot they're in because a friend of Jamie's from their time at Ardsmuir, Gavin Hayes, to be hanged for theft. And Jamie wants to make sure that the last face he sees, Gavin sees, as he is leaving this world is a friendly one. Now, Claire does not want to be there at all, but she's there to support Jamie. There were three prisoners to be hanged. Gavin, they see when he's let out, is like totally drunk. Thankfully, Jamie helped make that happen. That was really all he kind of could do. Before Gavin is hanged, they see that in his face that Gavin finds Jamie. And that's what Gavin was trying to do. He wanted to make sure that he saw that face before he left this world. So Jamie also had promised him that he would bury his body. So at this moment, before he's hanged, there's a commotion and they find out that the third prisoner, because remember there were three, had escaped. And the little glimpse that they had of him was that he was a tall young man and he had dirty blonde hair. That's all we get. Jamie grabs Claire and pulls her out of the crowd because once it's seen that this, okay, so I didn't skip it, but they hang him. They right. hang him. He sees his face and they hang him, and that's, you know, sad. That's not happy. But then the third slave, good grief. The third prisoner who's about to be hanged has escaped. They get a very small look at him. He's tall, he's young, and he's got dirty blonde hair. And of course, the redcoats, the soldiers are like running around trying to recapture him. The people, there's a huge commotion. Like the people are going to start like running out or trampling out, and there's a big like crowd trying to move quickly. And Jamie grabs Claire to protect her, and they need to find young Ian. He's not part of them. He's there in Charleston, but he's not part of their small group right now. And Fergus, who was also with him, whom I think I neglected to mention, leaves the little party to go claim the body of Gavin Hayes. Eileen P. writes, now that Jamie and Claire are in the colonies, we see further evidence of the outcome of Culloden. Whether shipped off as an indentured servant soon after the battle or sent to prison, then shipped off years later, families were separated and communication was virtually severed. With the downfall of Gavin Hayes, we appreciate that Jamie was sent to Hellwater rather than as an indentured servant to the colonies. Fortunately, with the influx of Scots to the American colonies post-Culloden, we learn that Jamie has kin near Cape Fear, North Carolina, kin that can aid Jamie and Claire as they establish a life together in America. Duncan joins them, and Jamie wants to go to the docks as soon as possible to arrange young Ian's passage so that he can return to Scotland. That is their plan. We learn that they are each, Jamie and Claire, holding a small hoard of gems. She has sewn her pocket shut, and he's wearing, first of all, his breeches are a little bit too tight, a little bit too small, but he's put his jewels near his family jewels, and it would take like a really extroverted hood to
he's got a jeweled codpiece.
Oh, pretty much. At least on the inside. It's not on the outside.
I mean, if I were a dude, I'd be like, I need to put these someplace in my pants. What's the best place for vanity's sake? And so that I would know if somebody was going to pickpocket them. He's like, I'm not going to put them like in my butt area, you know? Or he could put them in his butt. He's already carried one in there before.
That's true. I was about to say he wouldn't do it because he's not friends with his booty. But I guess
to be honest, he swallowed it the first time. And pooed it out.
Did he?
Yeah. Remember, because he had to wait. He had to wait for it to come out.
Oh, he didn't show it to John right away?
Uh-uh.
Oh, okay. So then Jamie sees young Ian looking, quote, indecently cheerful. Jamie is patting him on the back, and Claire is using her handkerchief to rub away a smudge on his cheek. So Diana uses these descriptions of their little reuniting here to show or to express Jamie and Claire in the role of his ersatz parents, of course. This is home. At this moment, this is home. Jamie, he continues, he wants to get that passage booked now. They want to get him on a ship called the Bonnie Mary, which is owned by a friend of Jamie's cousin, Jared. It was news of the presence of the ship that had brought them to Charleston from Georgia in the first place. Remember, dear listeners, Georgia, from the end of our Voyager read-along, as well as end of season 3, hallelujah, Georgia is where they landed, shipwrecked, about 2 months before. So not only do we get the distance they had come from Georgia, we also get the length of time. So it's been 2 months since they were shipwrecked in Georgia. In the book, they stayed with the Oliviers. In the show, I guess they couldn't find French speakers because the show has a hard time finding people who speak French outside of season 2. So it couldn't be Olivier. It had to be Oliver, but it doesn't matter. It's just funny because, I mean, you're going to make a change. That's just silly. But going forwards, not backwards. So 2 months ago from the moment in this chapter, they had landed in Georgia and they heard about the ship and that's when they came up here to this place specifically. Now, Summer, quick question. Was Gavin Hayes, and I don't think so, but was Gavin Hayes in Voyager? Was he one of the ones that traveled with them?
I think he was one of the ones who was transported, I think.
Now, Jamie did. Okay, so forget the boat trip. When they, in Voyager, in the whole thing in Edinburgh before the print shop fire, he did have friends there. Was one of his friends in the book Gavin Hayes? In the show, I know it was. I'm wondering if...
Dear Kindle.
Because I know I've heard the name, and it could just be because of season 3. Well, okay, while that chugs, I'm going to go ahead. So the family jewels. It is, or they are, a handful of large, valuable gemstones. But of course, they aren't really that helpful. Even though they're worth a lot, they're really not that useful at the moment. They're literally frozen assets. They'd have to find someone, or a banker, or a gemologist, a jeweler, someone who is active in them, who deals with them.
A dealer. He'd have to sell them. And then selling them, even just selling one of them, would make them a target because... If in small towns like that, all of a sudden somebody now has, you know, jewels, and then all of a sudden
word spreads.
So far, they have not mentioned him. The first mention of him is
at the hanging.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So that's, I'm going to go with that. So they had, though, given up one of the stones to Mr. and Mrs. Olivier, in whom we met-ish in Voyager, who had taken them in after they landed in Georgia. And in return, it was not just to say thank you. The Oliviers also gave them a wagon, 2 horses, fresh clothes for traveling, food for the journey, and a small amount of money. They probably still got a good deal, the Oliviers. Young Ian now leads the way. He says he wants to show them something. He says that it's something he won while dicing. Jamie freaks out that he gambled with money he doesn't have and says, like, do you know how dangerous this is? And young Ian replies, you do it all the time, uncle.
Seriously, it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to do that. But it's a parent thing. It's a do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly. Jamie is learning this because he spent a very little time with Willie. He spent no time with Brianna. So he's learning this because... He's learning the father thing. And then we find out, what did he win? A dog. Claire says, that's not a dog. It's a wolf. It's a bloody big wolf. And I think you want to get away from it before it takes a bite out of your arse.
Right.
Unquote.
Like, she's so funny. The second this dog wolf comes in the scene, or wolf dog, whichever. I think he's more wolf than dog, so we'll call him a wolf dog. Every time that Claire, as narrator, mentions this dog, it's always that I think he's just, he licked his face, but I think he was tasting him for whether or not he'd be a good treat for later, or the dog looked a little too eagerly at so-and-so's whatnot. I mean, it's just every time she mentions that dog, she has absolutely zero trust for that dog.
Now, Jamie isn't as wary as Claire is. He's, and of course, we know this from book books one, kind of two, but mostly book one, and hearing all about his upbringing, Jamie is not only good with horses, he grew up with dogs. He loves animals, but he loves dogs and loves horses.
Didn't he also have an Irish wolfhound in the books? Pretty sure they like Bran. Wasn't Bran an Irish wolfhound?
I think they had a deerhound.
Well, okay. Well, deerhounds
they're close.
They're not the same breed, but they're very close. They're large dogs and they don't look that dissimilar that I'm fairly sure that because this Rollo is part Irish wolfhound and part wolf. That it probably, while it maybe does resemble a wolf more, but the size is what it's getting from the Irish wolfhound, I believe.
Yes. Jamie is not as wary. He steps right up to examine it. And it's a cross between a male wolf and a female Irish wolfhound. Claire is still not having it. Quote, "Now Jamie was crooning in Gaelic to the monster while he picked up its huge foot and fondled its hairy toes," unquote. And they actually all have one fear because Claire's like, "I am not a fan of that dog." And Jamie's like on the fence, like, "Oh, I don't know." But then something that unifies them or unites them is like, how the heck are we going to feed them? We literally have like almost no money, even though we're kind of rich.
Right.
But we can barely pay for any food at all. How are we going to feed this dog?
It's like stock market money. It doesn't really exist until you sell it. So it's like saying that you're worth $3.5 million or not even just the stock market. Let's say you have a painting that's been appraised at $5 million. It's not really worth $5 million till you can find somebody to pay you $5 million. So
how are they to feed him? Well, thankfully, Diana foresaw this problem and Diana taught the dog how to catch fish for himself. Wow. So Diana's like, we are going to take that out of
the dog and equation. Nature taught him how to do that.
Maybe. Thus, dear readers, we are introduced to Rollo, one of the favorite characters from here on out. When Claire says the captain of the ship won't want a dog there, meaning, you know, because they're still trying to get Ian on this ship. Was it the Bonnie Mary? I think I said. Ian's still happy. He's like, Ian just doesn't see anything negative right now. And we find out why he's still happy. The ship sailed 3 days ago.
Could you imagine? Like I just envision him having this like shit eating grin on his face. Like,
exactly. That's the word. Exactly.
You know, just like.
So, Uncle. Yeah, guess what? About I have that. To tell you.
Because he never wanted to go.
Of course not.
And what young boy in his right mind would? You know, it's like now, how's he going to, we've said this before, how's he going to go back to the farm now that he's seen Puri?
Oh gosh, yeah.
And after the scope of adventures he's had since he was kidnapped off of Selkie Island, I don't think that I could ever go back to living provincially at Lallybroch.
Eileen P. writes, "You would think young Ian would want to return to Lallybroch after being kidnapped, sexually assaulted, and almost killed. Yet young Ian is intent on staying with Jamie. This must be very exciting for young Ian. He's seen Jamaica, Georgia, the Carolinas. You know what they say, how you're going to keep him down on the farm after they've seen Puri. As luck would have it, the Bonnie Mary has already sailed. Ian must stay with Jamie and Claire and Rollo, his new wolf dog." But at the end of the day, the worry, quite frankly, is Jenny. And Jamie's like, "Well, what is she going to say?" Ian replies, quote, "I didn't ken, Uncle, but she'll be saying it in Scotland, won't she?" Diana, I love this.
He has all the answers, young Ian does.
Good Lord. So they go to find a drink because it's, have I said yet that it's hot and humid and sticky? Like every third paragraph is Claire trying to like pull her shift away from herself to like make a fake breeze or wipe up her sweat. They go to find a drink and they go to a tavern called the Willow Tree. And Rollo is with the group, but as he walks, like crowds part. So he impresses or terrifies everyone. They go find a table to sit down at, and Rollo crawls into the table and like not rolls, but like it wouldn't say roll. What do you say? Curls up. There you go. He like curls up a little bit and he's like feigning sleep. At least he's resting under the table. and the people chat about their next step. Duncan and Ian are all for going north to Cape Fear. Claire says, quote, "The fact remained that Ian was the sort of person to whom things happened, usually through no fault of his own, but still they happened," unquote. Okay, this is very rich coming from you, Claire.
Dude, chaos monster.
I was about to say, that is, we need, okay, we have very, we're going to have to get some kind of t-shirts made because this is too much. So we need chaos monster shirts. We need hashtag tear prick shirts. And we need, what was the other one? Grange shirts.
Grange. What about kilt friction?
That's cute. I mean, that's kind of like smexy, but there's nothing wrong with that. I wouldn't wear it, but I would wear chaos monster because it we know what it means, but it's also like, it's kind of intriguing. So if you saw a t-shirt with that, you'd go like, wait, what? I would ask at least, or I wouldn't ask, but I would wonder. So if you guys have any other ideas of things that are phrases that we or our community has come up with, let us know, because we want to make sure that we offer those if you guys are interested, because heck, I am. Already thinking about the adventures he might have. Young Ian is excited to meet with, quote, forgive me, dear listeners, quote, Red Indians, unquote. Or the great foul things called skunks.
Oh my God. I'm smelling those driving home tonight. I don't know.
Oh, maybe I did too, or yesterday. I did too, way out in the boonies.
Bunch of deads.
When he says it like this big, fierce, with this great big, not big, but these great foul things called skunks, Claire almost chokes on her ale.
I mean, they are foul.
They are, but they're not. But Claire's like, Claire knows exactly what they are.
Right.
So hearing these 18th century bat, you know, either actual or wannabe badass men express fear over a skunk.
Right.
It is funny. She assures them that skunks aren't dangerous. Quote, "I canna say I wish to be meeting a bear or pack of savages. We only this to hand," unquote. And this is Jamie, and he's touching his knife. So yeah, see, that's the thing, is they don't have any weapons. They have knives or little dirks. Now back to Cape Fear. Cape Fear was the largest settlement of Scottish Highlanders in the American colonies, including Jamie's kin. Now Jamie, displaying his sort of Celtic voodoo sight, says he can feel eyes on him, but that they're in no danger at the moment. And Claire's like, And Duncan fills her in. While they were there in the crowd and Gavin was to be hanged, Jamie called out to Gavin on the gallows. Duncan says, "There will be those who took notice." Quote, "McDo being the biddy wee fellow he is," unquote. And people who they traveled with from Georgia, because they didn't come alone. They came with kind of like a, maybe not a caravan, but like a crew. Not peddlers, but people who were selling things. They were bringing goods to sell further north, like think to Maine and New York, if I remember correctly. And a lot of those people who had traveled with them had also stopped off in Charleston for, you know, relaxing, to have a beer, have a drink, spend the night, you know, get a little bit of relaxation in before they had to, you know, keep going. And these people who had traveled with them, didn't just join them, but traveled with them from Georgia, they might be spreading their story around as they relax in these taverns. And they might share an idea of the treasure that they carry. It's not that they necessarily know, but someone you've spent how long traveling with may have gotten a glimpse at something, or at the very least overheard something. And bringing more attention to themselves by Jamie calling out to Gavin was probably not the smartest. So that's what Jamie meant when he said, "Do you feel the eyes on us now?" Or he's like, "We're fine right now, but we really need to like not stick around too much longer." The plan is to bury Gavin and decide in the morning where to go. And then just in time, four redcoats enter the tavern. They're looking for something or someone. Now Fergus, who actually had gone to procure the body and make arrangements, slips into the tavern. So he was not sitting with them yet. He reports that the priest, an Anglican one at that, wants 10 shillings to bury Gavin in the churchyard. And they really have very little choice. The only other option would be to bury him in the woods. But Jamie and Duncan both knew that they would not do that. They could not do that because Gavin was afraid of the dark. He wouldn't like the idea of being buried in the wood. He was afraid of spirits.
I love that she chose to do a prologue about ghost stories and ghosts and then follow it with this.
And this is what I wrote. Him being afraid of spirits harkens back to the prologue. So yeah, absolutely. So Gavin had seen a Tanisk, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. Forgive me, but that's my best. Tanisk. His son, Gavin, had brought in the cattle one afternoon evening, but one was missing. So Gavin, responsible farmer, goes out to look for it. He went so far that he could no longer see the light in his window. His wife had lit a candle so he could find his way back. He finds a grove and goes there, but it was a circle of trees and there was a cairn in the middle. Now Claire, at the mention of this cairn, gets a tingle down her spine. Gavin turned to go once he realized what it was. And then he heard footsteps. Now what I want to know is, he's not walking on cobblestone. Or on tile. He's probably walking on dirt or mud or grass.
Or leaves.
If you're in the grove, if you're in an area where trees are and then you're leaving that area, then I would buy that there might be some leaves on the ground.
Or it was a circle of trees.
Footsteps are different than leaves crackling.
But isn't he in the woods?
I thought it was odd to have sound of footsteps, because even in the woods, you don't hear footsteps. You might hear a crackle, but that's the sound a footstep makes. It's not a footstep. Footstep is something you hear when someone is walking with high heels on a hard surface. Any heel that's not soft, that has any kind of click, and those have been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah, but let's put it this way. A footstep in an old house that has creaky floors,
A footstep is a ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Or some kind of rhythm of a step, even if it's slow. A creaky floor may be caused by a footstep, but it's the result of one, not the sound of one. I know, it's like splitting hairs, but I...
And I would still call that a footstep.
I do think they're different, but look, I didn't write it, so it doesn't matter. He walked and walked. And he never saw the candle he was looking for. And he finally couldn't take it anymore. He took his wooden cross, the only thing he had on him, and turned around to confront what was behind him. It was a figure like a man, but with no body. It was all white, like it was made of mist, but great holes where the eyes should be. Gavin prayed to the Blessed Virgin, and the thing didn't get any closer. So, because this had been slightly successful, he kept or started to walk backwards. And he kept walking and walking and walking until he saw the candle. So that he must have been like, he couldn't have walked home backwards or he wouldn't have seen the candle. He must have walked like sideways home. You know what I mean? The house could not have been behind him. He must have been like on the side or something, but whatever. And he sees the candle and okay, so he knows he's home. And this, even reading about this kind of freaked me out too. So he saw the candle, he turned to his door, but the cold thing was so quick. So this monster or this apparition, this thing was so quick, it slipped past him to stand between him and the door. His wife had been watching him, and when she heard him cry out, she went to the door. Gavin shouted for her not to come out, but to get a charm to drive away the Tanisk. She grabbed a twig of myrtle bound with red and black thread and dashed, it was from like a little pot or something, and it had water, I'm guessing holy water. She dashed water against the doorposts, and the Tanisk jumped up astride the lintel. Gavin ran beneath it through the doorway and closed and barred the door behind him. He never again left his house past sunset, except when he went to fight for the Bonnie Prince, which is ironic. So, because of all of this, they will be sure that Gavin will be buried in consecrated ground. Now, to answer someone's question, someone asked, Gavin never knew what happened to his wife and child after Culloden. Jamie and Claire kind of eyeball each other. I'm sure Duncan had an idea too, but Jamie and Claire kind of eyeballed each other like, yeah, we're not going to go there. So I think it was young Ian asked what happened to them. And Jamie and Claire knew exactly what happened to those who survived the battle, who didn't fight, but were, you know, the families of those who had fought or died. Now, as they talk about Gavin checking lists for the possible outcome of his son and maybe his wife, like finding out, you know, what happened, if were they sent somewhere, they agreed that if it had been them, they wouldn't want to know for sure. And Claire says, quote, our child, or at least she's thinking this, quote, our child was safe after all, unquote. And I wrote, careful, Claire. Now, they want to honor Gavin with song, and they have, you know, admittedly had a few drinks by now, or at least they're not completely sober. Quote, without warning, he flung back his head, and this is Duncan, and emitted a terrible howl. Now, this is kind of entertaining, and it even is so entertaining that Diana makes sure that we know that Rollo didn't like it. And then how he calls out the English. He calls them, quote, wicked Sassenach dogs, eaters of dead flesh, all while looking at them. Of course, the redcoats don't understand Gaelic, so they're like, once it was clear, because he made such a ruckus that it like scared people, they like stood up and were like, oh my gosh, what's going on? Well, once everyone understood that he was just like singing a song or doing a lament, doing something, they actually kind of, they fell into stride. They did the same thing. There was a refrain that basically said, hear him, listen to him. And they picked it up. And so after every new like stanza or every new verse, they would say that. And the redcoats joined in. And so what's funny is that they were saying, hear him, like, yes, listen to him. And most of what he was saying was foul about the English. So it is humor. It is humorous that they're basically toasting to their own cursing, to themselves being cursed. And Fergus, who is inspired by all of this, everyone jumping in, everyone, you know, exclaiming, hear him, stood up and passed around his hat among the crowd, and they began to fill it with money. He is always ready to do something that, in this case, it's not shady, but it's definitely taking advantage.
But that's true. And the show this last season really honored that, with the episode with him and Ian and their money-making schemes and how they should go into business together because they were really good at selling
the Clem de Malt.
Whatever it was. They were really good at getting rid of the casks of alcohol.
So, Claire, it was so funny. So she definitely, like, Diana's never flinched from this, but we all know Claire can hold her own booze. But she said something that was very true and very, very funny. She's like, I could hold my alcohol, like, in my head as well as most men, but my bladder couldn't. So she had to go outside and have a wee. Then she stays there. And she's just kind of looking around, and we get a little bit of the sense of the air, the weather, the temperature, all of that outside as she's just sitting outside for a little breather, for some fresh air, although it is thick, heavy air. And as one of the singers, not Duncan, as one of the singers is singing a bar song, and she catches the tune. As the singer inside finished his song, Claire sings to the same refrain, to the final lines.
Okay, before you do that, because I know you're going to do it, can I just say, reading it, just the lyrics of it, I didn't catch on right away, but with Davina singing it to the exact tune, it was no surprise whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. And Davina, and that is why I understand if, because not everyone's voice is, not every voice that I love will Summer love and vice versa. And not every voice that we love will you guys love. And some people are just not audiophiles. They're not into audio. It's just not their jam, and that's fine. But one of the things that I find so amazing, and Summer just proved my point. Well, prove you can't really prove. Summer just illustrated my point because it's opinion. Reading something is beautiful, and you're definitely, it's a different medium. It's a different interpretation. It's a different, like, you may not stress in your reading, in your head, in your reading of a line, something that an actor would, right? And that's their interpretation. So it's, nothing is necessarily wrong. It's just different. And having different interpretations and different modes of experiencing the content is fascinating. And Summer illustrated that beautifully right there. And I agree, because I listened to Davina read it, And I got to the end. I was like, oh, that's so, you know, like, it's not like she's not a bad singer. She's just not a singer, but she can hold a tune. There's no problem with it. But seeing it on paper and then hearing it performed again by the voice of Claire, whom you've had in your head for more than 20 years now, Summer, because it's now, well, I guess, yeah, 21 years now. It is a little bit freaky. It's wonderful. But hearing the voice of Claire go from like narrating, right, telling a story, into singing something, it's a different experience. But because of what exactly this song is, we already know it's the national anthem. It's our now national anthem, which truly was a bar song. It's based on a bar song. And knowing that Claire lived in Boston for 20 years, that was her own daughter's national. I mean, it was, you could say it was hers, but it was definitely her daughter's. Her daughter was definitely an American. She would have heard that, you know, maybe not daily, but many, many times. And so hearing Devine, like reading it on paper, I knew what it was. I was like, oh, that's interesting. That da, da, da. But hearing Devina start in with the song was almost not chilling, but it was almost like gave me goosebumps, because not only gave me a different perspective or like touched me in a different way or affected me in a different way, it did so many things. It reminded me of where they're at and when they're at. It reminded me that Brianna's not with her. You know what I'm saying? It had so many, holy monkey balls, girlfriend. It hit so many things that did not happen to me when I read on a flat piece of paper.
Given Claire's choice of career and the potential hours she was working and when she'd get home from work, she may not have gone and heard this song at ball games or, you know, to begin any kind of sporting event. That's not her thing. However, there was a time in my lifetime when the TV stations would stop broadcasting. And every night when they would stop broadcasting material, they would end with like, maybe not all the channels, but there was at least one channel. And if you've seen the movie Poltergeist, you've seen this. There's at least one channel that would end there, that would sign off for the evening with an image of a flag waving in the breeze. And this song, have you even said what the song is yet?
Oh, the national anthem.
Okay. And with the national anthem playing, like instrumental. Yeah. So while she may not have heard the lyrics all the time, she would definitely have recognized the tune, which would have jogged her memory for sure.
What does Claire sing, or what does Devina sing, when she hears these final strains of this song in a bar?
She sings the last lines of the Star Spangled Banner.
So this is how it ends. The singer's voice cracked painfully on voice, fiddle, and flute. But he sang stoutly on, despite the laughter from his audience. I smiled wryly to myself as he hit the final couplet. And besides, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with Bacchus's vine. I lifted my cup in salute to the wheeled coffin, softly echoing the melody of the singer's last lines. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? I drained my cup and sat still, waiting for the men to come out. Eileen P. shared the original text to the song that the music of the Star-Spangled Banner was written to. We'll share that link in the show notes.
All right. And that was chapter one of Drums of Autumn. I almost said Dragonfly Amber.
That's going to be our shtick this year, I can tell.
I know. Oh, my gosh. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapter two, entitled In Which We Meet a Ghost.
There's a hell of a lot of ghost theme already starting up now.
Well, yeah.
We did it. Chapter one. We did our first episode for our Drums of Autumn read-along. We also want to thank Dallas Crane, the very talented composer who gave us a number of some wonderful musical compositions to use in our Drums of Autumn read-along. And we will, over time, share them all. But we are so happy and so thankful that Dallas, again, shared his talent with us. And we will link to his page and his information in our show notes. So thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.